All right, podcast family, we're going to have some fun in this episode. Yes, we're going to give you some data. We're always going to give you some references, of course. But this is one of the episodes, one of the times where I cover something that you just have to stop for a second and just go, what is happening here? Wait, what?
What?
Oh, what just happened?
As you know, I get ideas for the episode, not only from stuff that's in print or new things that are coming out as practice alerts, but from stuff that happens in everyday practice. So, no joke, in one morning, guys, one morning, I was at our university clinic, and I had three things happen to me one morning that I talked to one of our MAs. I'm like, what in the world is happening out there in the community? I'm gonna tell you here what these three scenarios were that just made me flip my lid. Because I was like, oh my gosh. And at the heart of it is that these poor patients, all who were between 18 and 21 years of age, missed out on some good care by somebody else in the outside community. Now, let me be very clear. I'm not throwing anybody under the bus at all. I'm not going to give any names at all. But these are three separate patients whose three separate providers back in their own home cities or home states offered some information or did something that is not only not evidence-based, but is an obstacle to good care. And so I thought, you know what? Oh, my goodness. This is just wild. I've got to, remember these things. Two, I'm going to do this as an episode because this is why we're doing it, guys. I mean, look, I've been in medical education since I was a resident, because we always taught medical students even during residency, when I was junior faculty, and of course, even now up to today. And I believe in this because I would be heartbroken if my daughter, who's a freshman in college at another institution, went and this provider, if she went for something and they said, oh, you must have X, Y, or Z, or I'm not going to do X, Y, and Z because of this reason, I would just feel so disappointed, especially from a women's healthcare provider. Okay. So let me just give you the three things, and I'm going to go into it here with fully referenced, of course. And I thought we'd have some fun with this because, wow. I mean, seriously, when you think you've heard it all, you're like, have we not already addressed this? So I'm going to give you the three scenarios right now, and we're going to dive deep into these. We're all going to learn something. Okay. The first is I saw a 19-year-old. Otherwise healthy, young woman, she's doing fine, and she came in for something completely different, UTI symptoms, and of course, during my whole review, said, okay, well, let's talk about contraception, you know, sexually active, yes, male partner, yes, any issues, you know, you're okay with your relationship, yes, we went through the whole spectrum. And then I said, okay, well, great. Well, let me just give you some health information, just something that you don't forget. Mark on your phone that when you're 21, put it like on your calendar, after your 21st birthday, remember to get up, make an appointment for a pap smear, because some point in your 21st year, you need a pap smear. And that would have been the case whether you're virginal or not. She said, oh, I've already had a pap smear. What the what? I said, I'm sorry, what? Are you sure? A pap smear? She goes, oh, yes. The cervical cancer test. Like, she even knew what it was. I thought maybe she misunderstood. Maybe it was testing for gonorrhea or chlamydia, which she had as well. But I said, I'm sorry, did you have a pap smear already? And she said, oh, yeah. My physician back home in Pennsylvania, before I went to college or left to college, she said I needed to have a pap smear because I couldn't get put on birth control pills until I had a pap smear done. Oh no. So I almost fell out of my chair. I was like, oh my gosh. Wait, stop. Let me catch my breath because I'm not mad at you at all. I'm thinking, actually, we need to talk about this, but oh my goodness. And hence became the mini lecture to her about why she needs a new women's healthcare provider. So this patient, guys, before she left to college, when she was 18, by the way, had a pap in order to get her prescription for combination birth control pills. Y'all, I almost lost my mind. So I want to go over all of this because what the heck is happening? We're going to address it. And is there any test that's required before initiation of combination birth control pills? The answer is yes, although it's kind of loosey-goosey. So we're going to talk about, there actually is something that the CDC and the World Health Organization both say we should probably do this thing before prescription birth control, and it's not checking for STIs, and it's damn sure not doing a PAP. I'm going to get into it. See, I'm already all worked up. Whew, I still got two other things to cover. That was the first one. The second thing was, Y'all, I'm telling you, look what's out there. And you're like, you just have to literally, like if you're driving a car, pull on the brakes and go, did I just hear that right? What? Let me explain. Second patient comes in and said, hey, one of our nurses, nurse practitioners came in and said, Hector, I got to just run this by you because please tell me that I'm not over-exaggerating in my response to this because I was so just dumbfounded by this. So let's hear it. Said, I got a young girl. She's got PCOS by clinical history. She's had that for a while. She's off birth control pills. And she took a home pregnancy test and her pregnancy test was positive. I'm like, okay, I'm following. I get it. And I said, wait, let me just make sure. She's having sex with a male unprotected, right? Because hey, just ruling out the chance that it's some kind of weird ovarian secreting HCG tumor, right? It's possible. Rare, but possible. She said, no, she's having sex with a male, unprotected, right? And she had a home pregnancy test. I'm like, okay, I'm following. It seems like the answer is pretty darn clear to me. But what's the question? Well, so my nurse practitioner says, well, this patient, again, the student at a university, I mean, she's got some wits to her. She's smart, right? I mean, she's in a major university in the country. She said she reached out to her provider and said, hey, I'm a little concerned. You know, I've got a positive pregnancy test. I thought it was difficult for me to get pregnant with PCOS. You know, what's going on? Here it is, y'all. I'm telling you, this is real, okay? At another institution, at another city, okay? I'm just going to say you're not in this area, but in another city, this women's healthcare provider told this patient that it's possible that PCOS can give a false positive pregnancy test because HCG sometimes can be released with PCOS. What? I mean, what? Again, so I almost had a mini stroke there. I'm like, I'm sure you misunderstood. She said, I'm telling you, this patient said that her doctor, a women's healthcare provider, said that a positive urine pregnancy test can sometimes happen with PCOS. I almost darn lost it. So we're going to talk about it because there is controversy that PCOS may or may not actually rise abnormally, just a little bit, another hormone, and it's not HCG. Do y'all know what it is? Ooh, well, if you don't, I'm going to tell you in a minute. But that's super controversial. Most say that that relationship between PCOS and this other hormone is not existent. It's a separate pathology and it should be worked up individually. So never blame it on PCOS. We'll get into that in a moment. And the third situation. So I mean, I had these two, right? I'm going through my morning. And I'm like, wow, those two were weird. I got a pap and an 18-year-old to get birth control pills. Meanwhile, my angina is already going down from hearing that. And then I get hit by this other one that PCOS can give you a false positive pregnancy test. So now I've got a mini stroke happening. I'm like, oh my gosh. Okay, let's see what else happens. Well, then I get a third, I get a text from one of our old students, okay? And says, hey, Dr. Chop, I hate to ask you this. I don't know if it's some kind of weird boundary thing, but I'm just so confused. And I'm at my wit's end. I'm like, well, let me see how I can help you. And this student said, look, I went to my OBGYN. All right, my OBGYN. I'm like, I'm following because I've got, you know, my acne's really getting out of control and I'm on birth control pills. But my OBGYN said, oh, acne, you need to go to a dermatologist. Now, remember, this is one of our students, okay, one of our medical students who remembered this and said, well, can't I just switch to another birth control pill, maybe something that has like a spironolactone, like a drospirenone? And the OBGYN said, I'm sorry, I don't treat acne. You need to go to a dermatologist. What? So that was my third. And I'm like, that's it. I'm done. I'm done. What? An OBGYN who does not treat acne in a reproductive age female? Of course we do that, guys. We do that. Now, that's different than Accutane. Accutane, you have to be an Accutane registered provider in the database because it's part of the iPledge system. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But oh my goodness, please do something for this poor patient. We could switch through types of birth control. There's topical agents that can be done. There are mild low-dose antibiotics that can be ordered. That is in the wheelhouse, guys, for OBGYN. Now, we're not dermatologists. We get that. But there's a fantastic article that we're going to review in this as well called What the Pediatric and Adolescent Gynecology Clinician Needs to Know About Acne. This actually came out in 2021. It was on the then ABOG reading list. We had to read. This was one of the articles you could have read. And it just goes over, yeah, of course, we're going to be able to address this to a point up to Accutane If we are not comfortable writing for that and we're not a provider, we can refer that. But there's a whole list of offerings that we can do. And so I thought it'd be fun, just as a reminder, we'll go through a brief classification of mild comedomal, mild inflammatory or mixed, moderate acne, severe, and then very severe or nodulocystic acne, which is really the only time that isotretinoin can be used by itself. That is with severe nodulocystic acne. So even Accutane is really reserved for that. Now, you can use isotretinoin or Accutane combined with other topical agents for moderate or severe, but typically it's for very severe nodulocystic acne, which you can send to family practice, who's a Accutane provider, or to dermatology. The reason I'm not an Accutane provider is because in my multidisciplinary group, remember, we have family medicine, we have family medicine OB, we have OBGYN, we have behavioral health slash psychiatry, and we have sports medicine slash pediatrics. So we're multidisciplinary, so I don't have to be an Accutane provider because there's others in my group that are. But it just flipped my lid that this patient who knew what to ask for, asked for the right thing. Her OBGYN physician said, I'm sorry, you need to go to a dermatologist for that. Heartbreaking. Absolutely incorrect. So those are our three cases that we're just going to touch on. Is that crazy or what, guys? So we haven't even gotten to the data yet. So we're going to get into what test is recommended. There's one test for combination birth control pills, and it's not a PAP, and it's damn sure not a PAP under the age of 21. Ooh, I'm already irritated again. Number two, we're going to talk about, does PCOS make HCG get detected in the urine? No. So there's a spoiler. But we're going to talk about another hormone that may or may not, and the answer turns out probably does not affect its level. We'll talk about it. And then number three is, does OBGYN or women's health care, if you're a nurse practitioner, women's health care a PA, certified nurse midwife, are you able to, is acne in your wheelhouse? Short answer, as you've already guessed, is yeah, damn sure it is. I mean, at least help somebody so that you don't put a barrier into care, because we know that acne is a big self-esteem issue. They have to be comfortable with their body, and we don't want that to develop or spiral downwards into body dysphoria. So absolutely, we're going to go through a couple of recommendations from mild comedomal, mild inflammatory or mixed acne, moderate, severe, and then very severe or nodulocystic, based on the algorithm that's given in the Journal of Pediatric and Adolescent Gynecology, right? So we've got three things to cover. We're going to try to do this quickly because I'm trying to make these episodes a lot shorter. So let's just get to all of that right now. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice, because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, my goodness. So, yeah, I almost flipped my lid when this poor little, otherwise healthy 19-year-old with no vaginal bleeding, she didn't have pelvic pain, she just went in, she's like, I just want to get checked before I go to college. And the provider said, and I need birth control just to regulate my period. And in case I become sexually active, it'll be good to have. So the provider said, can't give you birth control until you get a pap smear. Now, I understand if there's something weird going on, like you have to do a cervical exam because there's weird bleeding, something, some weird odor or whatever. But guys, 19 asymptomatic. And so this poor patient, of course, not having any idea, she's like, okay. And so I had to just make sure. I'm like, are you sure it was a pap smear? She said, yeah, well, they checked me for gonorrhea, chlamydia. And they said they were going to do the test for cervical cancer and to see if there was any HPV. Wow. All right. So, and so she knew the words. I said, okay, well, I believe, I think that you got that. It's definitely not necessary until 21. In no guideline. Actually, 21 is the earliest because based on who you read, you can do HPV testing starting at 24 or 25, again, based on who you read. So definitely nothing at 19, although it used to be a thing. Remember, 3 years after initiation of sex or at 18, that used to be a guidance. So I just had to ask, look, this practitioner, is this person a little older? Not throwing anybody under the bus, right? Just curious. She said, yeah, you know, she's kind of older. I'm like, okay, all right. So I would give some grace, guys, if this changed like last year. It's been 21 for a long ass time. So this poor, again, it's nothing hurtful. And I told the patient, look, the test didn't hurt you. You didn't get any treatment for it. Thank goodness. It just was completely unnecessary. So if you go back to that provider, which I'd recommend that you find another provider who's more current, do not let her do another annual exam. Because if she did one at 19, I'm darn sure she's doing it annually, which is also not indicated. But can you believe this? And so this poor patient, all she wanted was birth control. Now that we've said that, let's set the stage correctly. Is there any test that's required for combination birth control? Well, let's go broader than that. Any test required for birth control in general? And the answer is yes, there actually is. Guys, according to the CDC and the World Health Organization, there's only two things that should be done based on the prescription of two very specific birth controls. Okay, so if you ever asked what test is necessary for birth control, wait a minute, wait, that's a huge question. The answer is just as big, and it depends on what kind of birth control you're talking about. If you're talking about progestin-only pills, that's over-the-counter. That's now called the O-pill, which we've covered on this episode many times, and you don't need anything. If it is, however, for an intrauterine device or an intrauterine system, the CDC, ACOG, World Health Organization say at the time of placement, you should probably do a bimanual exam just to look for any weird fibroids, uterine distortion, try to get an idea of the feel of the uterus, and you're also going to do uterine sounding. You do not have to do a preliminary consultation first with STI testing and then wait for the results and come back. You can do same day testing for STIs. And if you find the patient has gonorrhea or chlamydia or trichomonas, whatever, and you've already inserted, just treat her and she'll be fine. Okay, she will be fine as long as she's treated. So you don't need a separate visit to collect STI samples and then bring her back. You can do that first as a general consultation if you like. And then once you bring her back, once you've ordered the device or pre-certed it or whatever, place the IUD or IUS at the same time that you do STI testing and at that time do a bimanual exam. So you see that. So what test is required for birth control? Well, the next answer is what kind of birth control? If it's intrauterine system, then most standards do a bimanual exam in that case. Doesn't say anything about a pap smear and doesn't say anything about blood work. It's just to get the orientation of the uterus at time of placement. Great. So that's that. The second test that can be required for the provision of combination birth control pills is a blood pressure. Guys, that's the only test that the CDC, World Health Organization, say is good clinical practice. The question is, well, if you need a blood pressure, how do online birth control companies do it? Well, I'm going to tell you that in a minute. But here is the bigger question. Why is that an obstacle? I mean, is that really necessary? Or should women just have all kinds of birth control over the counter? I kind of feel that way. I think it's very safe if patients can self-select themselves. Although combination birth control does have some different issues, obviously, than progestin only, like the O-pill that's over the counter. Okay, so it will take some work, or behind the counter, if not over the counter. You should at least talk to a pharmacist to get some kind of information if combination birth control pills in the U.S. go over the counter to self-select more appropriately, right? We don't want women with clots. We don't want women with a history of breast cancer. We don't want women with severe migraines with aura who smoke, have high cholesterol, and have hypertension to use it, and they're 40. You see what I mean? So there is some self-selection. But the only test that's recommended for combination birth control is a blood pressure check. I'm going to explain how online companies do it. But that is a very, very well-established intervention. The only thing for combination birth control suspension is a recent blood pressure, and recent is defined as within 3 months, and then another blood pressure check within 3 months, and at the latest, annually. But typically, you should check it within 3 months as good clinical practice to look for any idiosyncratic reactions to the estrogen in the birth control pill, all right? However, the performance of a PAP, to say that you need a PAP or a bimanual for birth control pills, if you're asymptomatic and you're not worried about STIs or anything else going on, totally unnecessary. Even back in 2015, ACOG's Committee Opinion 615, which was Access to Contraception, which pretty much said, look, we need to do better to remove obstacles. There will be a time when it's over-the-counter. And now look, now we've got the O-pill over-the-counter. But back in 2015, with Committee Opinion 615, ACOG has a whole block here, a whole little paragraph on unnecessary medical practices. So let me just say this here very quickly. Quote, this is directly from the committee opinion, okay? There is no medical or safety benefit to requiring routine pelvic examination or cervical cytology before initiating hormonal contraception. The prospect of such an examination may deter a woman, especially an adolescent, from having a clinical visit that could facilitate her use of a more effective contraceptive method than those available over the counter. Okay, sounds good. Now, what about the whole blood pressure thing? Now, ACOG doesn't actually go into saying here about the blood pressure, but it kind of does it indirectly, okay? Because remember, it wants to give out the message of access to birth control. But here's how you read between the lines about the blood pressure check to stay in line with CDC and World Health Organization as a safety feature for the patient, okay? Quote, similarly, healthcare providers should encourage patients initiating combined hormonal contraceptives, here it is, to start on the day of the medical visit, end quote. Did y'all get that? It's like, wink, wink, wink. It's like, hey, we need access. They don't have to come back for a separate visit. They can start the same day, make sure, of course, they're not pregnant, as the day that they come in at the medical visit. That's the wink, wink to check their blood pressure. Do y'all get that? So I've had this conversation many times throughout the years. We're like, well, ACOG doesn't say you need to do a blood pressure check. Yes, it actually does. It does right here. You got to know what that means. At the medical visit, what are you doing at the medical visit? Dang, you're checking your blood pressure. So please, some things don't have to be spelled out. It's very clear here. And just go to the CDC's recommendation, because I'm looking at it right now, where it states, blood pressure should be measured before initiation of combined hormonal contraceptives. I don't know how else to interpret that than that, because there's a whole section from the CDC webpage under examination and tests needed before initiation of combined hormonal contraceptives. And the only thing that's mentioned in here is the blood pressure, with the idea being that, hey, man, if somebody's blood pressure comes in to like, and they're 160 or 110, you've got other issues at hand. That's part of health maintenance. And it doesn't mean that you can start it with 130s over 80s, 90s, you know, class 1 hypertension by AHA, or even class 2. You just have to have a plan in place, because you definitely don't want these patients to become pregnant. It's just that knowing what their baseline is and then having a plan to follow it to start hormonal contraception with potentially an antihypertensive down the road if necessary, where that plan is already in place, okay? Now, here's what's interesting. Listen to this. This is according to the CDC, guys. I'm reading it directly off the CDC page, the reference of which will be on our reference page. This is why blood pressure checks for combination birth control. That's the only one, guys. Nexplanon, I mean, it's just good maintenance, but not really necessary. O-pill, not necessary. Progesterone-only pills, technically not necessary. It's the issue of combination birth control, something with estrogen that requires that blood pressure check. Okay, so what are the two tests that are required for initiation of some kind of contraception? Well, if it's an intrauterine mechanism, it's a bimanual exam. with STI checks based on patient's risk factor that can be done at time of placement. And then number two is blood pressure for the use of any combination birth control product, whether that's the pill, patch, or ring. Okay, that's it. There we go. So technically, depo doesn't require that, although you want a baseline weight because of the whole weight issue potentially with depo over 2 years. It's just common sense, guys. The question is, how do online pharmacies get around this? And I'm going to tell you in a minute because they don't really get around it. It's very clear in their wording, and I'll tell you what they do. Okay, but let me get back to the CDC's emphasizing blood pressure and the reason that blood pressure observation at initiation is important. So I'm looking at this right now under comments and evidence-based summary regarding blood pressure on the CDC website. Okay, quote, three case control studies showed that women who did not have blood pressure measurement before initiating combination birth control had a higher risk for acute myocardial infarction than women who did have blood pressure measurements. Also, two case control studies showed that women who did not have blood pressure measurements before initiating combination birth control had a higher risk for ischemic stroke than women who did have blood pressure measurements. And one case control study showed no difference in the risk for hemorrhagic stroke among women who initiated birth control, regardless of whether their blood pressure was measured. So one said, nah, not a big deal, but that was only for hemorrhagic stroke. And the other case control studies are like, yeah, we should probably check that. So based on this fair, direct evidence, the CDC says, yeah, based on what we know right here, it's probably an easy intervention that should be done to safeguard patients' safety. Okay, so there's obstacles like you can't get a PAP until, I mean, you can't get your birth control pills to do, I do a PAP. That's a damn obstacle. And then there's patient protection, which is where the blood pressure check comes in. All right, so let's say you're taking oral boards. We've already done this. Two tests that are required before initiation of birth control. I'm sorry, sir or ma'am, can you please explain? Because if we're talking about IU intrauterine systems, IUDs or IUS, that's a bimanual. If it's a combination birth control product like the pill, then that should have a blood pressure measurement and then followed up at 3 months and no later than a year. Those are the only tests done. Not lipids, not TSH. Not gonorrhea, chlamydia, although it's best practice if they're at risk before an IUD placement to do it at time of testing, all right? Now, other things like checking weight and those other tests are fine as part of health maintenance, but those can be perceived as obstacles outside of the two things that we've already discussed, all right? So in this review, it goes on to say, and then we're going to end here, and I'm going to give you what the online offerings, the online companies do and their wording regarding distribution of combination birth control, okay, and the blood pressure issue. But here's what the CD says regarding this blood pressure thing, then we'll call it a day. Quote, women who have severe hypertension defined as a systolic of greater than 160 or diastolic greater than 100 or vascular disease should not use combination hormonal contraceptives. Remember, that is medical eligibility class 4 on the little color chart that we've talked about before, the U.S. medical eligibility chart. That's category 4. They go on to say, and women who have less severe hypertension between 140 to 159 or diastolics in the 90s or adequately controlled hypertension generally should not use combined hormonal contraceptives. That says generally. That drops it down from a 4 to 3, which is risk benefits, discussion. You know, you got to have a good reason why a Mirena or a Nexplanon wouldn't work in this case to really stick with a combination birth control for somebody who has class 2 hypertension based on American Heart Association. That's 140 to 159 and then the diastolics in the 90s. All right. So even though you can, the wording from the CDC is generally should not use. It doesn't say should never use. It says generally. That's why it's category 3, which is you're starting to get into that pink zone of no-go and the color-coded chart. Remember, it's totally green, light pink, and then red as category 4. So severe hypertension or vascular issues, that is MEC4, and you would never know that unless you had a blood pressure check and its own appropriate workup. And then those that have more moderate hypertension or those even who have blood pressure control drops down to 3. So if that's the case, you either start them on medication, have short-term follow-up, or ideally, here it is, guys, ideally switch to something else. If they have hypertension, even if it's well controlled. It's all about risk and benefits. You can do it, but it's medical eligibility category 3. I would switch them to something else. There's plenty of other options than the damn pill. You could use a progestin-only pill. You could do a Nexplanon. You could do any of the intrauterine systems, okay? And what about clinical breast exams? As we leave this topic and go on to our other scenario regarding PCOS and HCG, well, the CDC has an answer for that too. Quote, although women with current breast cancer should not use combination hormonal contraceptives, that's a duh, screening asymptomatic women with a clinical breast exam before initiating combined hormonal contraceptives is not necessary because of the low prevalence of breast cancer among women of reproductive age, end quote. Now, I get that. That's true. That's fine. At the same time, remember, U.S. Preventive Service Task Force just updated the recommendation to start at age 40 because we are finding breast cancer among women in their 40s. However, breast cancer in women under 40, which still happens, we talked about that in a previous episode, it's much more rare. So I definitely don't do a clinical breast exam before initiation of combination birth control pills. CDC says that's not necessary. But I do tell them, I do reinforce at the medical visit where I'm checking her blood pressure, hey, just don't forget about breast awareness. I mean, you don't have to check every month after a period or after your withdrawal bleed if you choose to have that. Just have breast awareness, which is what Susan G. Komen, ACOG, and the CDC have endorsed just for overall body awareness and overall health maintenance. So the only test that's required and considered good clinical practice before initiation of combination birth control is a blood pressure check. So how do online pharmacies do it? Very easy. It's all in their wording. It's not hidden. It's not a secret. I took a look at 3 different online companies. Won't mention any. Not a sponsor, but they all have the same, very similar wording here, which is this. Hey, you can talk to a clinician online and they can figure out the best kind of birth control pill for you based on your questionnaire that you turn in and your brief little online session. But you must have had a normal blood pressure recently. Some define that as within 3 months. Others don't define it at all. And then they have this caveat. And remember, it's important that you have a follow-up session with combination birth control to see if there's any questions, any issues, headaches, nausea, whatever the case may be, and to have a check of your blood pressure documented. Now, the question is, well, if it's online, where are they supposed to get that? And the answer is anywhere. I mean, they can go to a clinic, they can go to the pharmacy and have a blood pressure check there. They can go to any paramedic, any firehouse and get that done. They can go to a health fair. There's a variety of places. They can buy their own monitor. The problem is that the home blood pressure monitoring has to be done correctly. They got to read the instructions. And so we tell patients that as well, even with pregnancy. Should we do home blood pressure monitoring, which our practice does, even though we know the data from the Bump 1 and Bump 2 trials, that's a little controversial whether that helps in pregnancy or not. I do believe there's a place for it with proper instruction, like don't cross your legs. Please don't take it with your, you know, when you're lying on your side and you're taking your blood pressure on the arm that you're lying on, for heaven's sakes. Please don't take it drinking your cup of coffee. And please don't take it immediately after running in from the Texas heat in the summer and then check your blood pressure. So there's caveats. You're supposed to be sitting down for like 10 to 15 minutes, legs not crossed. Arm is at heart level, appropriate size cuff. There's instruction, guys. So even though Bump 1 and Bump 2, which has to do with pregnancy, said, you know, unclear if it really changes overall morbidity and mortality. We've covered that in this episode in the past. I think there's a role with proper instruction. All right. So clinical breast exam, it's an overall good idea just to tell the patient about overall breast health. Clinical breast exam is also part of breast wellness as starting at age about 25, according to ACOG. You can do that every 1 to 3 years and then annually after age 40. Again, also as part of patient education. And we talked about that in our episode immediately prior to this one regarding the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force breast cancer update. Are we done with that? I think we're done with that. So that is my little rant on requiring a pap smear in a 19-year-old for combination birth control. I'm telling you, I wish I had a video of my face because I'm sure I saw, because she saw it. She's like, what's wrong? I was like, I'm about to have a stroke. Hold on. And not really. But you understand. I hated that this poor patient had a invasive procedure for nothing. All right, that rant's done. Now let's talk about PCOS and HCG. Thank you for being part of our podcast family. We really are grateful and thankful that you've chosen to take this journey of medical education with us. You're listening to Clinical Pearls. All right, everyone, let's just say it right off the bat. You know what gives you a positive urine pregnancy test? This is a tough one. Pregnancy? That's the, how about that? There's one for an academic medicine physician. If you get a positive pregnancy test in a young reproductive age woman who's having sex with a male without protection, ding, ding, ding. Man, look how smart I am. My first on the differential is pregnancy. Just saying, yes, there's weird stuff, like ACG secreting ovarian tumors. That's true. Don't send me a message like you forgot about that. I did not. But in a reproductive age woman who's having sex with somebody with a penis, who has ejaculation in the vagina without birth control, PCOS is not birth control. So what was this physician thinking? This physician told his patient, sometimes you can have a false positive pregnancy test with PCOS. No, that's not a thing. It's never been a thing. He should have, or she, I don't know, should have said, honey, I think you're pregnant. You need to go get checked. And if there's nothing in the uterus, there's other issues there. Is it an ectopic? What's going on? We've got to figure that out. Take a look at the ovaries. No, kind of brushed her off and said, I think that's PCOS. Now, look, I don't know this person. I bet you they're trying to do the best they can. But damn, that's just wrong. I mean, I was like, you have no idea how much I was just biting at the heels there to go, I need that physician's number. I just need it. I mean, like, what are you talking about? You misled this patient. And you could have given her a delaying diagnosis for a pregnancy, or what if it is an ectopic? I mean, what in the world? So no, there is no concomitant elevation of HCG with PCOS. However, there is a controversial tie, very controversial, with prolactin. Y'all, this goes back and forth. And here's how these two things are related. Remember, if you have a patient that you suspect PCOS because of anovulation, in other words, irregular periods, and classically, yes, let's say she looks like PCOS phenotype A. Remember, there's four different phenotypes. So I get it. I mean, you're like, probably PCOS. You still have to look for other things. You can't just go to that. Remember, of course, we have to exclude other potential causes, other potential endocrinopathies like thyroid abnormalities and prolactin disorders. Remember that prolactin and TSH are sistered tests, right? They go together because high prolactin levels could be hypothyroidism because of the TRH cross-stimulation. So you've got to look for other things. So I get it. Classic PCOS, classic. Still get that TSH, still get that prolactin level, and do other tests as necessary. If you suspect insulin resistance because of acanthosis, do that workup, whether that is a Roma test, whether that is a fasting insulin, whether it's a glucose challenge test. We've talked about all of those in the past, right? So the point is just don't go classic PCOS, that's it. Look for other things. And that's why prolactin has to be included in the workup, of course, of anybody with irregular periods. Just like you get a UCG, rule out pregnancy, unless they're virginal. You don't have any doubt that they're not virginal. So this relationship of prolactin and PCOS are actually controversial and has been in print for like 20 years, all right? Does PCOS cause a mild elevation of prolactin? Maybe. Unknown why, but severe moderate or severe, you cannot say that's PCOS. So let's get back to our discussion. Does PCOS cause an increase in HCG? No. But does it cause an increase in another hormone, prolactin? Maybe. It's controversial, but mild elevations may be through some weird shared mechanism, but moderate and severe elevations need to be evaluated for possibility of prolactin secreting tumors. This is also in the ACOG practice bulletin number 194, which is polycystic ovarian syndrome. I mean, the college reminds us of this. Let me read you exactly the excerpt from the college regarding this prolactin issue. Quote, mild elevations in prolactin are common in PCOS, end quote. So let's stop there. Mild elevation. So what is that? I mean, and so they don't really define that. I would consider that nothing more than it has to be under 30, right? So 25 to 30 is kind of the gray zone. Typically, prolactin is under 25. If you have a prolactin of 70, and just because she looks like PCOS, please don't say that's just related to PCOS. You got to do an evaluation. If it's 100, you got to do an evaluation. Mild elevations in prolactin, according to the college, can be common with PCOS. They go on to say a prolactin level can identify prolactinomas that secrete large amounts of prolactin that can stimulate ovarian androgen production. So remember that that's how they have shared presentations. High prolactin levels can shut off periods. High prolactin levels can actually work on the ovarian level to increase production of androgen. So guys, yes, hyperprolactinemia can give you hyperandrogenism. So that's how these two things get kind of mixed. So some of the studies that say there's no relationship to prolactin is because, man, they share a lot of similar pathways. You're just looking at an overlap, but they are distinct entities. The point is, don't forget to check for pregnancy in somebody with irregular periods that you suspect PCOS and look for prolactin because they very well could have two very different conditions here, prolactinoma and PCOS. They can coexist in the same patient. All to say, don't forget prolactin in the PCOS patient as a secondary cause of hyperandrogenism and irregular periods. Oh, wait, one more thing before we leave this whole PCOS prolactin association. Back in 2011, guys, I'm looking at it right here, Endocrine Abstracts, all right, out of the endocrine folks. This is actually out of the European Congress of Endocrinology, number 13. There was an abstract presented there on polycystic ovarian syndrome and prolactinoma association. How about that? So in this quick abstract, they state in 15 to 20% of PCOS patients, mild elevated prolactin levels can be functionally found without prolactinoma. So that's that again, that. OK, so this agrees with the college. All right, we're good. Now, think about those numbers, 15 to 20%. You can view that as a lot or not that much, whatever, 15 to 20%. But they go on to say, persistent high prolactin levels in PCOS patients who are reproductive age, prolactinoma must be taken into account after excluding other causes like drugs or hypothyroidism to prevent missing an important or critical diagnosis, end quote. There you go. So is there a relationship between PCOS and HCG? No, unless you're pregnant or have a HCG secreting tumor. So that was a separate issue. But is there a relationship between PCOS and prolactin? Well, it's controversial. Maybe. Sure. But that shouldn't stop you from looking for other potential causes of hyperprolactinemia, especially if it persists and especially if it's moderate to severe. All right. I think we're done with that. Now let's hit the last one, which is a pretty easy one on acne. All right, as we go into this last caveat, look, I'm not saying that we all function as dermatologists. I get that. We're not. But we still take care of acne. I mean, for this OBGYN physician to send away a patient who is asking for the right thing. I mean, this is an educated medical student who happens to be a patient. I don't know if there's a male, female OBGYN. It doesn't matter. I don't know that person. But I was just so dumbfounded that this physician said, acne, I'm only doing women's healthcare. You've got to go see a dermatologist. Oh my goodness, that is horrifying. Guys, I'm not saying that every one of us has to be an Accutane provider. I'm not. But we have to, I mean, at least have some compassion for heaven's sakes, knowing that acne is just not a bother. It can be a true self-esteem issue. So this journal article in the Journal of Pediatric and Adolescent Gynecology from 2021 is a nice review of this. There's literally one little table, super small, it's table two, and it is the algorithm for the management of acne vulgaris in female patients on the basis of severity. I'm looking at it right now. So it's super easy. Let's do this real quick and then we'll bring it home. First, if it's mild comedonal acne, that can be treated with a topical retinoid. That's Retin-A. No pregnancy issues. You don't have to be part of a registry because even though some of it is absorbed to the skin, it's rapidly metabolized, that's not an issue. Now, once you go from mild comedonal, so little blackheads, whiteheads, you go into mild inflammatory or mixed type, which now has a little bit more of the redness around the pimple itself, right? So that's mild inflammatory. You can still use topical agents, topical retinoid plus benzoyl peroxide. Okay. You can also, if desired, combine that with a topical antibiotic like minocycline or topical Clinda if desired. So we have mild comedomal, now it's mild inflammatory, and now we have moderate. Moderate now is a triple combo, okay? So it's typically a topical retinoid, benzoyl peroxide, and then you can add an oral antibiotic or hormonal therapy. So those are the three things, a topical retinoid, benzoyl peroxide, with or without an oral antibiotic or hormonal therapy like spironolactone, what my medical student was asking her provider for. How easy is that? Give that patient some Yaz or Yasmin or a drospirenone-containing product. What's the big deal? Weird. And I said, you got to run away from that provider. Run fast. All right, fine. So that was for moderate degree of severity. Remember, mild comedomal, mild inflammatory, then moderate. Severe now is including the antibiotic with or without hormone therapy. So we have the triple thing again, topical retinoid, benzoyl peroxide, and the oral antibiotic. The other one was with or without oral antibiotic or hormonal therapy, but now it's with an oral antibiotic, with or without hormonal therapy. All right. So again, severe. Now we're adding things. So topical retinoid, benzoyl peroxide, an oral antibiotic like oral Clinda or Doxy. And that can be taken no more, guys. You can do it twice a day for 2 weeks and then go to once a day, typically for about no more than about 3 months, all right, just to get away some of the initial inflammation. And you can combine that as well, of course, with isotretinoin, Accutane. For very severe or nodulocystic, it's just one agent. That's isotretinoin. Not that the others won't work. That's fine. They have a place. But you've got to hit it hard, and it probably won't get better without isotretinoin. So that's it. Those are the five different classifications: mild comedomal, mild inflammatory, moderate, severe, and then very severe, for which Accutane is the sole recommended algorithm, the sole recommended agent, according to the Journal of Pediatric and Adolescent Gynecology. All right, so now we have the information. So please don't be afraid of acne, and to treat that in a younger reproductive age woman who's asking for it, for heaven's sakes. My goodness, remember that acne is a manifestation of hyperandrogenism. So it ties very nicely back to PCOS that we just covered. All right, I think I've covered our three issues here. Of course, the references will be on our reference page. And I think that's it. All right, let's take it home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.